James chapter 3, verses 13 to 18. And I'm going to just start by reading the passage so that we all are refreshed on what it means or what it says. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Obviously, the topic is wisdom. So, we have to define the word wisdom before we can even continue this class. Oh, that's going to be fun. In fact, it's interesting, Philip, you used the word twice this morning, just in your commentary here. You prayed for wisdom for Carl. You prayed for wisdom in decision making. And we go, okay, well, but what does that mean? What does it mean to have wisdom or to be wise is a different idea, but what is wisdom? Well, let me do one more thing while you're thinking, because I know you just don't have this definition just bursting forth. When we were talking about the makeup or the canon of the New Testament, we had mentioned that the epistles of Paul are in the order they are found in the New Testament based on their length, nothing else. It goes from Romans to Philemon. Each book is successively shorter. The Old Testament is broken down into four different categories. The first five books of the Old Testament are what? The Law, the Torah. Then comes the books of history. So that's Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. Then comes the books of wisdom. Yeah, wisdom. And in fact, the poetry books are included in the books of wisdom. So you have Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Then comes the prophets, both major and minor prophets. That's the collection. The books of wisdom, then. They actually call them that. And you look at Job, okay. Song of Solomon? Well, I guess they didn't know where else to put it. So they stick it there. Proverbs, well, of course, Proverbs. Ecclesiastes, well, that makes sense because Solomon, King Solomon, technically wrote them. Then you have Psalms, which is more a kind of a combination of things. But you start looking at, no, that's not the best pen. Let's try a different one.
I'll use the black one.
I'll use the black one. There we go. There we go. Wisdom. Now that you've thought about it for a couple minutes while I just ramble on, what is wisdom? What is the definition of wisdom?
Application of knowledge.
The application of knowledge, okay.
Experience.
Well, believe it or not, the Greek word for wisdom is Sophia. And A.T. Robertson, in his Word Pictures of the New Testament, defined the Greek word Sophia as practical knowledge. So you're as good as A.T. Robertson. But what does it mean, practical? What is practical knowledge? What is wisdom then? I mean, we have an entire, in fact, many scholars classify the entire book of James as a book of wisdom literature. So we need to have a good sense of where it is, and here you have James writing about it very specifically. Any other thoughts?
Well, So when you say practical, do you mean useful?
Possibly, sure. Useful in what way?
Well, thinking of my husband being a philosopher, there's a lot of philosophy that's not very useful.
Very true, very good, okay.
There's some people who will spend so much time on something that doesn't really...
Doesn't really matter, has no application. It's theoretical. And theory is actually important, because sometimes theory then has an expression in the practical.
And you have the wisdom of the world foolishness.
Exactly. And in philosophy, it's the wisdom of the world. Exactly.
That deeper insight that is founded on what we just mentioned, the a holy standard that allows the penetration through knowledge, the use of that in the wisest ways.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy to define, is it?
It's not. Knowledge is not intuitive, but wisdom as a gift can be intuitive. But it's important to also draw the line between wisdom and discernment.
Cicero, 52 BC, said, "Wisdom is the best gift of the gods and is the mother of all good things. It's the best, and that's what generates all the best." So there's a secular Greek definition.
Well, and that's kind of what Solomon said in Proverbs, is seek after it. It's better than gold. It's better than riches. It's better than anything. Run after it. Seek after it with all you got.
Yeah.
But there is a difference between worldly wisdom and godly wisdom.
Yep. And that's what James actually talks about here. Good old Webster says, wisdom is the ability to discern or judge what is true, right, or lasting. And there throws in the word discernment into this mix. Alec Mature, in his commentary on James, says that wisdom is the God-given ability to see how, in all our ways, we may acknowledge Him.
Ooh, that's good.
Isn't that interesting?
Say that again.
Yeah. Wisdom is the God-given ability to see how in all our ways we may acknowledge Him, which is an echo of Proverbs 3, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
Trust the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding, in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths, or make your paths straight, depending on whether you're a King James or something else. So anyway, it means the same thing. God-given ability to see how in all our ways we may acknowledge Him. Now, it is well known, or at least assumed, that Solomon asked for wisdom. But did he really? 1 Kings chapter 3, I'll just read the passage. You don't have to turn there unless you'd like to. 1 Kings chapter 3, it says, "At Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, 'Ask what I shall give you.'" And Solomon goes on about God loved his father David, and he had walked with him in faithfulness. "But now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king, though I am but a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, with whom you've chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered and counted. Give your servant," meaning himself, "give me an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil." You don't have any place here where Solomon says, "Give me wisdom." He didn't use that word. God did. God replied, "Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself for long life or riches, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, I will do according to your word. I give you a wise and discerning mind." And then in chapter 5, verse 12, it said, "The Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he had promised. And then his wisdom is described as surpassing all the wisdom of the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman, Chalcol, Darda, sons of Mahol, and his fame was all through the surrounding nations. And then it says, he also spoke 3,000 proverbs and wrote 1,005 songs. He was this amazing, wise person, and people from all over the region would come to him to hear what he had to say. Ezra. Ezra 7, verse 2. God gave Ezra wisdom in order that he might be able to lead Israel. Daniel 5. Daniel and his friends were showing such ability, the king said they possessed excellent wisdom. So on page 2 of your handout, I collected a bunch of passages on wisdom. There's a whale of a lot more than these. And I decided not to only use the book of Proverbs, which I could have. And I also want to have it all fit on one page. Because when I first started, it was like 5 pages long, and I kept chopping pieces out, and I'll get a smaller font, change the margins, put it in double columns. I had to get it so I didn't have to keep printing out paper for you. But this is a fascinating exercise, and I also did not put it in biblical order. They're just kind of mishmashed together. So as you read these passages, I'll read a couple of them, but you start to realize how the entirety of Scripture points us toward the necessity of having wisdom in all things. Start at the top left. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. And from Ephesians, look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of time, because the days are evil. And jump down a couple passages. How much better to get wisdom than gold? I think someone mentioned that earlier here. Colossians, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of your time. Huh. That's a echo of Ephesians. 1 Corinthians, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks he's wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. And I should have added verse 19, where it says, the wisdom of this world is folly with God. Then in Matthew, Jesus said, everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like the wise man who built his house on the rock. Jump down, Psalm 90. So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. That sounds like Ephesians. Sounds like Colossians. Isaiah, there comes from the Lord of hosts. He's wonderful in counsel, excellent in wisdom. The beginning of wisdom is this. Get wisdom, and whatever you get insight. Then I combine 3 proverbs together. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. The fear of the Lord is instruction and wisdom, and humility comes before honor. And then Psalm 111 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There's a theme here, don't you think? Get wisdom, get insight. Don't forget, do not turn away from the words of my mouth. I've taught you the ways of wisdom, and I've led you in the paths of righteousness. Down in Psalms 19, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. You get the idea? The entirety of Scripture. Jesus, Paul, James, Isaiah, Solomon. It's all continuously going at this idea of wisdom. So, we have to also remember that the structure of the book of James has been a series of tests. There was the tests of trials in chapter 1. Then came the tests of temptation, also in chapter 1. Then the test of how we, as believers, respond to the word. Then was the test of the needy. Then the test of righteous deeds, the works, the idea of showing what you do. Then the test of the tongue, and now becomes the test of wisdom. We've already picked up on some of the ideas here, that there's a contrast between the world's wisdom and God's wisdom, but let's look at what James has to say about it. I will start by this statement, which I don't think anyone in the room could disagree. Well, maybe you could, because of what I'm saying. We live in an ocean of opinion.
Are you kidding?
I mean, when I first saw the phrase, it was a sea of opinion. I went, oh no, it's not a pond, it's not a lake, it's a sea. It's an ocean of opinion. It used to be that you had to earn the right to speak. Now, anyone with a phone can speak and make your opinion known, whether or not you know what you're talking about or not. Your opinion is yours, and you will present it as vociferously as you can. Everyone is an expert. Everyone has an answer. But James asks, so who is wise and understanding among you? It's chaotic. Where do you go? Where do you turn? How do you know? Now remember, I work in the publishing world, and the intent of publishing is to publish ideas in its various forms, either through fiction, nonfiction, narrative, memoir, all sorts of ways of writing information or inspiration or entertainment is the way I like to put it. But it used to be that there was a gatekeeper. It was the publisher who would determine which books they would fund to then be put into the marketplace. Now, literally everyone in this room could have a book on the market by this evening. It's that easy. If you've already had it written, who cares whether you have it edited? I mean, anyway, we'll... I need to hold back because I'm not in a rant mode. But if you have it written and you can figure out how to sign up on Amazon Kindle Direct, you can press publish this afternoon. And by this evening, your book is available electronically anywhere in the world. It's that easy. One man decided to show how silly the, I think I may have told you the story before, but how silly the ease of publishing is. So he created a book, one-page book. And the first page of the book was a picture of his foot. And he called the book, My Best Foot Forward. And he classified it as a book on podiatry. It was number one. Because there's no other books on podiatry out there. And he bought one. He had two of his other friends bought one. And it was given a banner by the bots on Amazon as the number one bestseller in podiatry. And he took a screenshot, did an entire article in the New York Times or whatever saying, this is ridiculous. Yeah, he's right. Anyone can have an opinion. But who is wise and understanding? This is a difficult time that we have. You know, those of us who are adults, we have watched this sea, this ocean, started as a trickle and now it's a flood coming upon us. But think of the next generation, your children. it will be normal for them that there's 1 million voices on every opinion out there. Normal. So how do we teach discernment? How do we know what is wise and understanding? And what's fascinating to me is that the one book that doesn't change is this one. It has not changed and will not change. And if we believe in the source of it as being from God, well, maybe we need to turn to this first instead of our favorite commentator or Facebook friend, etc. Because James's question is not one for just the bygone days. It suddenly seems incredibly current. Who is wise and understanding among you? Wise meaning that Greek word Sophia. The word understanding is a Greek word called epistemon. You may recognize epistemology from that. It's the idea of knowledge. Who has knowledge? Who has understanding? And it just happens to be this is the only place in the New Testament where both Sophia and epistemon are used together. No other place. And the word epistemon in this form, it's only used here in the New Testament. But who's wise and understanding among you? If you remember, James earlier had already talked about wisdom. James chapter 1 verse 5, he says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to you. But ask in faith, without doubting, so you aren't a double-minded man. So who's wise and understanding? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. We run over that verse a lot. We just kind of just run past it. But look at what is said here. By his good conduct. That word conduct actually has a larger expression. You could actually use the word lifestyle. By his good lifestyle, let him what? What does it say? Let him
show.
Didn't he just talk about the importance of showing your faith through your works? In other words, you can say, I have faith, I have faith, I have faith, and then go cheat on somebody, either in business or relationship. And someone will go, but you said you had faith, but you're doing this. I mean, it's probably not true, but there was a story that came out of England many years ago, probably 100 years ago, where a fellow, a journalist, was trying to see who had integrity among the those who claimed that they had integrity. So he sent the same letter to 15 well-known moral men. And the letter said, flee. We know what happened. By the end of the week, they were all out of the country. And he's, you know, the whole point is that everyone has secrets. No one is completely moral. In other words, there was this double life. Now, my guess is that was probably a sermon illustration created to make a point and then turned into this grand story that now has legs as being true. But still, there's that idea is their good conduct is one thing, but to show it is another. And to show it in the meekness of wisdom. Now, someone who is truly wise, who truly has wisdom, we probably would, at least in our society, man, tell me if you agree with this, we'd probably give them a TV show, or at least a radio show, so that we can disseminate their grand wisdom. And the next thing you know, you surround that person with people who tell them how good he is, or her, how good she is, and how smart she is. And there's no one around that person to counter their own ego. And the next thing you know, you have someone who is bigger than who they think they are. We've seen it. It's distressing. Biblical wisdom, as it shows here, is the wisdom in meekness. Meekness? Now, that's the Greek word praus. And when we were looking at the fruit of the Spirit, which, by the way, is chart number 3 in your handout, if you want to pull that out. This was actually my own worksheet. As I was working on it, I thought, why don't I just give it to the class? So you have in the first column, James chapter 3:17 is the description of wisdom. Then you have the fruit of the Spirit, and I tried to connect across where they were repeated. And then there was also the Beatitudes, which seemed to reflect a lot of the same things. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. 2 Peter has a section called the Road to Character. You know, if you have virtue, it does this, and then this does that, and it just has this trail of wonderful things in the end of the trail. And that particular list is love. And you start realizing that James, Paul, Jesus, and Peter are saying the same thing. That's one of the reasons why I picked those four passages, because they're four different authors. The Greek word for meekness is praus. The Greek word for gentleness in the fruit of the Spirit is prautes. And if you were here when we were going through the fruit of the Spirit, this was one of those challenges of what is the difference between gentleness and goodness and patience. They're all very similar. But meekness and gentleness, at least in this case, are the same word. It also happens to be, let me find it here, in James chapter 1, verse 21, it says, therefore put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with praus, meekness, the implanted word which is able to save your soul. It's the same idea. Robert Johnson, who is a writer in 1871 on his commentary in the book of James, he wrote, the meek should inherit the earth. They who bear wrong and exemplify that love which seeks not her own to a world which believes in high-handedness and self-assertion and pushing the weakness to the weakest to the wall. A statement like this of the Lord from heaven cannot but appear to be an utter paradox. The man of the world desires to be counted anything but weak. Sorry, anything but meek. Yeah, that was a Freudian slip. Anything but meek or poor in spirit, and would deem such a description of him as equivalent to a charge of unmanliness. If someone came up to you and says, man, you are so meek, I'd probably go, that's not a compliment, not in our culture. And yet, we're being asked to be that, right here. It's, you cannot walk away from this verse. You can't. We are being asked to, in our lifestyle, to show our works in meekness of wisdom. The wisdom to know what's right and what's wrong. The wisdom to know how to express our life as Christians in this world. So, to help, as a good pastor does, he helps his congregation by going into verse 14. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't boast and be false to the truth. I mean, bitter jealousy, this is, let's see, let me get the word jealousy right. Yeah, okay. Bitter jealousy is pikron, zealous. Now, that's the word that you think it is, to be zealous or zealot. Then that can have both positive or negative. It just means you're really intense about it. Pikron is the same word that James uses in chapter 3, verse 11. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and pikron water? Bitter, undrinkable. Might look like water. You pour it into your cup. Great looking water. I live in Flint, Michigan. Yummy. You swirl it around, you take a drink, and you get sick. Or, if you've ever taken or done some tap water in some location somewhere, and you take that sip and you go, whoa. Or, as you raise it to your lips, there's a smell that comes off the water because of the chemicals that are in it. This is that insidious type of thing that you can't see it at first. But in its action, it has really negative connotations. That's what he's saying here. Bitter jealousy is not something you wear. You have this little medal going, I'm bitterly jealous of you. No, it's in how you act. It's that expression of it. So if you have bitter jealousy or selfish ambition, this Greek word, fascinating. Apparently, it originally meant someone who was paid to work. Like a work for hire. A day laborer. You know, I'll give you this coin if you dig that ditch. Thank you very much. But then it grew to mean to work to try to get something. In other words, the only reason you took the job is because you wanted the coin. So it kind of flipped it.
Yeah. Mercenary.
A mercenary. Good idea. Exactly the same idea. You just, whoever will pay you, I'll do the work. Then it carried another meaning, and they began to apply it to politicians that would do whatever it took, whoever would pay them for their vote. And then it later even grew beyond that to all forms of selfish ambition. Anyone who would do some sort of action or activity for their own improvement for themselves. Very selfish. And that's what this ultimately means when James comes along and says, if you have bitter jealousy, and remember his audience, it's us, it's the church. He's writing to his congregations. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, last thing you want to do is boast about it. Yeah.
Could that selfish ambition be prostitute yourself?
Potentially, sure. Sure. That would be a outgrowth of someone who has no ethics. They're just willing to do whatever. But so often, people get tied up in what is this for me? I will only do as much work as you tell me, as long as it improves me, if you pay me for it.
Yeah, what's in it for me?
What's in it for me? Which is a common problem. And those of us who have ever been in management, someone who works and goes beyond what you ask them, without asking, you kind of go, huh, I don't even have to pay him for that. He just did it because he... Kind of like our son-in-law. He just did it. He did the things. He wasn't asked. He just, this is what you would do. I'll work longer than everybody else. I'll send everybody else home and I'll sweep the whole place. The boss comes back and goes, why is this place clean? Because that's the way it's supposed to be. See, it's this idea of the opposite that we're looking at. Now, in church, we have to be really careful, and I remind myself of this all the time. I cannot sit in that service and say, what's in this for me? Sitting in worship service is not about me. It's just not. It's about God. It's about us worshiping Him, giving Him all the glory. And if He chooses to bless us, if He chooses to inspire us or to give us strength for the day, that is the blessing. But I cannot go in there going, okay, show me. You know, entertain me. Sing good so I can feel good. Oh, it's so wrong. A.W. Tozer said, is a great quote. He said, if you're bored in church, you're not ready for heaven. That's a good point. So there's a story of a man who was, he was on a deserted island for 5 years by himself, all by himself. Finally, he was discovered. They came to the island, and there were three buildings on the island that he had built. And he goes, what are those three buildings? Well, I live there, and I go to church there. And I said, well, what's the third building? Oh, that's the church I used to go to. I mean, don't we do that? It's like, you know, this isn't exactly the way I like it, so I'm going to go to another place. Oh, that's just not smart either. Anyway, verse 15. This, meaning what he said in verse 14, this is not the wisdom that comes from above, but it's earthly, unspiritual, and what? Whoa. He's not playing around here. He's not just throwing that out as a superlative just to kind of get the audience to go, ooh, ah. He's making a point. Earthly. It's bound by time and space. It is human. This word unspiritual, boy, this is a tough word because, well, I'll write it up here for those of you who are wanting to pass your Greek exam next week. So it's psychikēs. Now, in the Greek, there's soma, body, soul, and spirit. So you can see there's a connection here. This is an E, all right. And that's an S for those of you who are trying to follow along. So you can see this connection here. It's fascinating because the ESV and the NIV and the King James all translate it as either unspiritual or sensual. It's actually the word natural. But if you have the word natural in there, in our English, the word natural has a completely different meaning, as is ordinary or regular. He's talking about the natural man, the natural impulse. The 1 Corinthians chapter 2 has it. Let me get there. Chapter 2:14 says, the natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is unable to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. So the natural person in 1 Corinthians 2:14 is the same word. So that's the idea. The idea that it's part of our who we are, how we're made up. But it says then it's demonic. This is the only place in the Testament where this word is used as an adjective. Demoniacal. It's a description of this. So this earthly wisdom is spawned by demons. Where there is jealousy and selfish ambition, same words as we have up in verse 14, where they exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. The word disorder is the same word that is translated as unstable in chapter 1, verse 8, where a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. He's disordered. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 21 says, "Woe to you who are wise in your own eyes." Oh, there we have the warning. And then he just goes into the various words, which I have in the chart. What then is wisdom from above? Well, first, it's pure. Hagnos. Not the typical word you find for pure in the New Testament. The typical word is hagios, or holy. This is a different word. It has more to do with the action, not the result. So you are being pure, or this is the action of purity, not the result of the action. Just to make, you know, it's like coming at the same thing from two different directions. So it's spiritual integrity or moral sincerity. It's used of Jesus in 1 John 3:3, where it says, "Everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is hagnos," or pure. An inscription was found in the temple of Asclepius, with an inscription by an archaeologist found, said that he who enters the divine temple must be hagnos, must be pure, must be clean. So this has an element of holiness, but it's the result of their actions. The next, peaceable. So we could all agree with any of these. I mean, we're not going to have an argument here that these are all good things. But what is he trying to say? Peaceable. Eirnikos. Eirnikos. To be peaceable. I know I butchered the translation, but whatever. Blessed are the peacemakers. If there's conflict, bitter, jealousy, and selfish ambition. Peace usually doesn't happen in the midst of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. Not usually. Actually, never. Because one person is going to win, or they will do whatever it takes to win. The argument, the situation, the dialogue, that's not peaceable. And then he uses gentle. Now, before, remember I said the word gentle or meekness was here. And then in the fruit of the Spirit, it's this word. Okay? Not here. This is a completely different word. I-E-I-K-E-S. How would I pronounce that? Help me. Epiakus. Yeah, Epiakus. Now, according to, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 different commentators, of all the Greek words in the New Testament, this one is the most untranslatable. It's the only time it's used. It has very little correspondence in regular Greek literature. I mean, there were struggles to define this. John MacArthur, I'll give you his attempt. It has no satisfactory equivalent in English, but it carries the idea of equitable seemly, fitting, fair, moderate, forbearing, courteous, and considerate. A gentle or Epiacus person is humbly patient, submits to dishonor and abuse and mistreatment and persecution. So this isn't just being gentle. There's a depth to this that James is trying to convey to his people. He could have used the word protest. He could have used the word prouse again, but he didn't. He used something completely different. Matthew Arnold, the old writer, wrote, he called it sweet reasonableness. So Chuck Swindoll used this illustration. He said he remembers when he was young and strong in the faith and just all vim and vigor, he was working in a plant. And he said there was another fellow he was working beside who did not believe the same things Chuck did. So he used every tool of his apologetic acumen. He was just filleting the guy every day with arguments, just pounding the guy. Finally, after weeks of this, the fella turned to Chuck Swindoll, young Chuck Swindoll, and said, "Chuck, I am not going to change my mind, no matter what you say." And Chuck said, "I paused, I was taking a deep breath to give him all the reasons why he was wrong, and then he said, because I don't like you." Chuck said, "It stopped me in my tracks. And I have never forgotten it in my 50 years of ministry. Because I realized I was hammering him to try to get him to change his mind rather than loving him to show him how, to what does the verse say? To let your good conduct show your works in meekness of wisdom." He said later he had a teacher at Dallas Seminary, Howard Hendricks, who said, "They won't care how much you know until they know how much you care." Fascinating. So the next one is open to reason or easy to persuade. Now that doesn't mean he's gullible. It just means you're willing to listen. President Lincoln once gave an order for a troop transfer during the Civil War. The Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, refused the order. I mean, that's a fireable offense. They're in the middle of war. The Commander-in-Chief says, "You move the troops from here to here." Secretary of War goes, "No, you're a fool. It's documented." President Lincoln said, when he heard this, he said, "Well, if Stanton said I'm a fool, then I must be. Because he's right almost all the time. So I better check it out." So he went over, had a conversation with Stanton, and rescinded the order when he realized how foolish it was and how destructive it would have been to the troops. Lincoln was open to reason. This is wisdom. It's knowing when you stand firm. It's also knowing that there are times where you need to just listen and go, "Well, that's a good point. Well, actually, that's a really good point. Well, actually, you're right. I need to change my mind. I need to change my decision because of that." That's wisdom. And the wisdom is full of mercy and good fruits. It's impartial. Oh, goodness, he had 13 verses on impartiality. Just at the beginning of this chapter. You don't say, because you're rich, I'm going to listen to you, and you're poor, well, you're obviously an idiot because you're poor. That's just not right. It's not the smart way to do things. And then he says, and to be sincere, the underlying word is not hypocrite. That's the Greek word underneath this word sincere. Not hypocritos. And the last verse, and I'll just touch on this here. which I think just makes a very interesting observation. The verse says, "And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." Now look at that verse again. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. You don't sow harvest. You sow seeds. So what's he saying? A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace? Here's how I look at that. At first, you look at, oh, it makes perfect sense. Well, actually, no, it doesn't make sense at all. A seed of righteousness is sown in peace would be the correct way, except we know what the fruit will be. We know the harvest before we even sow the seeds. This is what James is saying. In God's economy, in God's biology, righteousness happens because we're sowing the seeds of wisdom and peace and understanding. It's not that you do this and you certainly know, you hope that you have a good harvest. He's saying we know what the harvest is going to be before we even sow the seeds. We know exactly how many corn we're going to get. We know exactly the fruit of that harvest. This is not an equation of question or hope. It maybe it'll be a good year. By saying it this way, he's saying that righteousness is always the result. Always the result of wisdom from above. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for our time together. Your word is full. There's so much here. We keep coming back to it and just in awe and being awed by your word and its practicality. I guess all we can do, Lord, is pray for wisdom. In all that we do. In all our actions, all our activities with those around us, that our wisdom or the wisdom from you shows itself through how we treat others, so that the fullness of you comes through and not the fullness of us. Thank you for our time together. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.